do a little maintenance. Be turning back to the passage, if you will, in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 that Wes just read for us. Tonight we're going to begin a short series of lessons. The only way they're going to be connected, because I'm going to do three different subjects from them, but they will weave in and out of 1 Corinthians 10. In other words, all three lessons will be taken from 1 Corinthians 10, and yet the subject matter, I'm not really making them sequential, so if that makes sense, it's a series without being serious. I really want to look at three lessons out of this chapter, or that may be taken out of this chapter, and three lessons that I hope will be lessons that support the overall idea of, what we're looking at, the idea of remembering what we are as we go through this particular quarter of the man in the mirror. Although I may not make a whole lot of reference to the man in the mirror, still these are lessons related to that. And when you look at this passage in 1 Corinthians 10, remember those of you that can make it and want to be part of the prayer service next Sunday morning. I meant to announce that this morning, but next Sunday morning, if you can be here about 9:40, the ladies and the men will meet in different rooms and we'll do the prayer. As you look in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, I want you to notice that obviously, as Wes was reading, obviously, Paul is making a comparison between the Christians, Christians there in Corinth, Christians now, and us as well, making a comparison between us, them, and the Jews as they were on the Exodus in the Old Testament. We might go to Romans 3. I'm not going to really turn there, but you may remember Paul poses a whole question about the Jews. And he asks the question, what advantage then, after he spent some time really talking about the judgment that there is upon Jews, what advantage then has the Jew? And Paul answers that. He says, much every way. And when you begin to think of that, you think, okay, the Jew was very advantaged. He was very advantaged as far as the rest of the world. He had, it doesn't mean salvation couldn't come to other people in the world, but certainly the Jew had a personal knowledge of God. They knew God. They were people who were taught by a steady stream, for most part of their history, a steady stream of prophets. Certainly beginning with Abraham, who's considered the father of the Jews, beginning with him, God would have different people throughout their history, who would lead them, who would teach them. They had that advantage. And Paul points out, and I won't go to that everything he says in Romans 2 and 3, but Paul points out they had a lot of advantages. And so the Jew was a very advantaged individual over many, certainly, of the world around him, but also, starting with Moses in particular, and that would be a time that would be referenced here in 1 Corinthians 10, they were advantaged over their predecessors, the Jobs and even Abrahams that came before, because God made such a specific covenant with them. We oftentimes emphasize the downside of the law of Moses. The law kills and all of that kind of thing. But yet God gave it to them because of transgression. And the whole idea was, if you have the covenant, it should keep you on the right track, so to speak. So even in itself, and Paul points that out in Romans, that was an advantage to have that. Well, Paul, as you look here at 1 Corinthians, Paul compares their exodus, their journey. I don't know if you remember last year, about a year and a half ago, Jeff Smeltzer taught a lesson, and he pointed out, he said, I don't often talk about Greek words, but the exodus comes from a couple of Greek words, and it's the road out. I don't know if some of you may remember that, because that's what the word means. It's the road out of slavery, the road out of Egypt, and the road certainly to freedom and to the promised land. Well, in the New Testament, That same word, the middle part of Exodus, that O-D part of Exodus, in the New Testament is a word that's used for Christianity, and often. The idea of the way, or that way. When you look at 1 Corinthians 10, Paul is talking about the way of Christianity. And he's comparing the journey that the Christian takes with the journey the Jews took in the Old Testament, specifically during the Exodus. The Christian, likewise to those Jews, shares many advantages. In fact, far more even than the Jew had. The Christian has many advantages, but he also has a number of threats. Things that threaten his place, his position in Christ. If you think back to the Jew on the Exodus, they were coming out of slavery. They were headed toward the promised land. They were advantaged in many ways by God, and yet there was a great threat to losing all of that. And eventually, except for two people, everybody over 20 did lose it, even Moses. So when we think about it, what Paul is saying here in 1 Corinthians 10 is you have a lot of advantages like they had, even in a greater sense, but you also have a lot of threats to your place or your position in Christ. And so I think he gives examples, and you can see that here at the beginning of 1 Corinthians 10. He gives these examples, and these things serve as examples and warnings that we may likewise fall into the same traps, etc., they did, and we may likewise lose our place, certainly lose our blessing, as they did. In other words, we might find ourselves, and I hope you hear what I'm about to say, we may well find ourselves, even though we are members of the church, kind of wandering around aimlessly through life and never reaching the promised land. And that's what happened to them. So it's being offered as an encouragement to us that that doesn't happen. Again, look at the passage Wes read just a moment ago. Moreover, brethren, Paul says in chapter 10, I would not that you should be ignorant how that all our fathers were under the cloud and all passed through the sea and were all baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea. Why is he saying that? I mean, certainly there's the figurative idea of the cloud and the Red Sea, and we talked about it, many people have talked about it and compared it to the whole idea of being surrounded by water, and that's a beautiful parallel to baptism. That's right. But why is he saying that? And I believe the reason he's saying that in this passage is to say, you know, all those Jews back there that lost their blessing, they were all baptized. Like you, Corinthians, you, brethren, are all baptized. And you know, the truth is, you may speak of having the New Testament, and we often do. We speak of knowing that we are part of the covenant, we have the New Testament, we learn the Scriptures, etc., etc. They drank of the same spiritual drink, and they ate of the same spiritual food, and again, they ate of the same, meaning the same as whom? Each other? Yeah. But as you, Corinthians. And we speak of having the advantage of Jesus Christ, and I think sometimes we look at that and we say, well, we, and you hear this popularly even out, you know, outside the church in the debates of the world, Christians have Jesus Christ, but what Jews forget is they had him too. And so Paul points that out. And they all drank of the same spiritual drink. They drank of that spiritual rock, verse 4, that followed them, and that rock was Christ. So they had Jesus too. So what he would be saying to Christians, whether it be the Corinthians or you and me today, is remember the Jews. Remember the Israelites coming out of slavery, headed toward the promised land. They were baptized, just like you are. And they had the same spiritual food, just like you do. They had the Word of God, is the idea. And not only that, they had Jesus Christ. And if you notice, this is a very interesting picture of Jesus in this verse. I want you to look at it carefully with me, because it's an extremely interesting term that's used here. That rock that followed them. I think when we think of Jesus, we often think of Jesus as the leader, and rightly so. He leads and we follow. But in this case, It's Jesus doing the following. And what you understand when you look at the word that's used in the original, that the idea here is of one who's watching, but it was a term that was used for someone who was older, someone who knew the way, someone who lingered back, though, and watched over in a protective sense, someone who was making the journey that was a novice. In other words, it might be a commander of the military who had disciplined and trained his soldiers to march and told them where to go. And then and you see the picture often, he lingers back. He doesn't ride at the head of the army. He lingers back, but he's always there to know if the soldiers are going the right way, to come in to help if they need help, etc. I often compare this because I think most people can understand this picture. It's kind of like the idea of a parent who is going to let their child walk to school for the first time. Maybe that child, depending on where you live in the country, etc., maybe that child is a first grader, second grader. But they're old enough, they've been taught, you know, the parent has taken them by the hand and led them to school and all of that kind of thing. Now they're a big boy, you know, and they're going to walk on their own. And so the parent tells them, today you walk to school by yourself. Or this year, maybe they start a new grade, etc. And then that kid takes off and begins to walk to school, but the parent follows. Child doesn't know that the parent is following, but the parent lingers back and follows the child to school. Why? Because the parent wants to make sure that the child doesn't get off track. The child is not lost on his way. The parent wants to make sure no harm comes to the child, that he really has learned all the lessons. You know, look both ways before you cross the street or whatever. Well, that's this term that's being used here. It's not a picture of Jesus at the front and we line up behind him and we walk behind him to wherever we're going. That picture is used elsewhere and it's a correct view. It's just not this one. This one is the idea of having that rock, that solid foundation that you can always rely on. If you get tripped up, if you get lost, if you get distracted or detracted from where you're going, he's always there. I don't know if any of you have this. We do. But and many people do. You know that old saying, a lot of times it's put on a picture and you see the footprints in the sand. And the idea of, you know, there's two sets of footprints and all of that, and then at times there's only one. And the times when there's only one, the story goes on to tell you, that's the time Jesus says that I picked you up in a carriage. Because I was always following you, I was always there, and I was always ready to come in and help you when you needed it. Now that's the picture we see of Jesus. And that's what we see of Jesus with his people. And I want you to understand whether we're talking about Old Testament people, whether they realized it or not. The Egyptian soldiers and chariots are bearing down. No need to worry. God is there. And just like you and me today, regardless of what's going on in my life, and that's the point being made here, Jesus is there. Jesus is the solid rock, and that's where my hope lies. We're going to stand and sing a song, and I'm going to get Kenny to lead it. My hope is built on nothing less. I'd like you to stand up, kind of stretch a little bit. I want you to really sing this song with a lot of vigor. And I want you to think about the words in this song, my hope is built on nothing less than Jesus. Let's really sing out as we sing number, 438? 438. I'm going to step away so I don't blast the microphone here while we're singing.
My hope is built on nothing less than Jesus, Lord.
No, I didn't.
It's what Paul is emphasizing. Now, what stands out in the passage, and I dare say the part of it that many times people go and refer to, are all the mistakes that the Jews made, all the sins, all of the complaining, etc. And I want us to look at that, because I want us to think of the threats that there are to us and of God's displeasure with His people. Ultimately, those Israelites, God was so displeased with them that they lost the promised land. And it's an example to us, because we certainly don't want that to happen to us. So with all of their advantages, the Lord was not pleased. And you notice, as it says in this passage, the Lord was not pleased with many of them. That doesn't mean there weren't exceptions. We would look at a Joshua, for example, a Caleb, and others like them that certainly were exceptions to that, but with many. And so, as you look at these next few verses, and you see the shortcomings of the Israelites, remember, I'm not going to spend a lot of time going back to the Old Testament and looking at the various stories, though I'll touch on a couple of them. But just remember the kinds of things that they did and how they were caught up, and go back to the stories and ask yourself, why? Why were these people, why would they, with all they knew, with all they had seen, why would they do the things they did so that God would be so displeased with them He would just cut them off and say, I've had enough? And why would we, with everything we know and every advantage we have, why would we fall into the same trap? Well, as you look at this, you understand that the kinds of things that are mentioned here, and I'm talking about in verses 6 through 11 in particular, the kinds of things that are mentioned are very common things. We may look at, you know, the story of the golden calf and Aaron making the golden calf and all of that. We may kind of, you know, look at this, man, how could they do that? You know, how can you go through what you've gone through in Exodus? You've seen the Red Sea part and all of that kind of thing. How can you do that and then turn around and worship, some idol made out of gold? But when you stop to think these are human beings, and you listen to their frustrations, and you hear the fear that's in their voices, and you listen to how they're unsure, they're not sure of God, and then you begin to be honest with yourself and you say, as we were this morning, is that me? Am I the kind of person that says, I'm not sure about God? You know, I know I'm supposed to be and all of that, but really in my life. And I have the same kinds of fears, etc. You notice the things that are listed here. Let's just kind of run through them very quickly. And I want you to notice, too, that as we go through these things, and it's interesting to me, this is something that I guess I just thought about the first time not too long ago. But it's interesting that all of the things he lists, there's a particular way that we're taught about it in the New Testament. I've got the verses down there for you. Go with me to Colossians 3. You see, first of all, these things were our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things. In Colossians chapter 3, the Bible teaches us that Jesus should be our life. That Jesus should be the central figure in our life. That our affection, our love should be set upon Christ. And yet, when Paul says that, he turns immediately and begins to talk about your lust. And if you notice in verse 5, he says, mortify therefore your members which are upon the earth. And then note, fornication, uncleanness. And then notice how he says, inordinate affection, King James, of course. It's translated all over the place, but I'm going to talk about the relationship between the words. Inordinate affection, evil concupiscence, and covetousness, which is idolatry. What happens in a human being is that there's a progression, or digression, if you prefer. We start desiring things that we know are wrong. And if we allow it to do so, that desire will intensify. We will want something, even if we know it's wrong, we will want it, and we'll want it more and more and more. When you look at these terms, there are three of them here in Colossians 3, verse 5. The mildest lust or desire is the term that's translated inordinate affection. In other words, it's just an affection, an affinity for something that's out of place. But then it moves to what the King James calls evil concupiscence. And if you look up concupiscence, and it is an English word that's still in the dictionary, though hardly used, but it's the idea of having a strong desire, even an intense desire for something. It's kind of like the person that's dissatisfied with their spouse who begins to be attracted and allows that attraction for someone else to intensify. I really want that person. But it's not yet the third and final term, covetousness. Because to covet means you want something and you pursue it. You're willing to do something wrong to get it. And that's the last position that you find yourself in. And you'll notice, he says, and that's idolatry. Why? Because now you're serving that desire instead of serving the Lord. But you've allowed it to grow. You've allowed it to build, intensify in you until you give over to it. You give in to it. Now, if you think about what the Bible teaches us, I want you to look over at 2 Timothy 2 and down in verse 22 and notice what the Bible says about how to handle your desires that are out of place. In other words, your simple lust, you want something, but you know it's wrong, it's out of place. Notice as Paul said to Timothy, very simply, flee also youthful lust. I think that sometimes that's kind of strange to people, funny that the Bible would teach you to run away. But that's literally what it's saying. When you know that you desire something that's out of place, when you know that your desire is wrong, and we do, when we know it's out of place, run from it. In other words, do whatever you have to do to get out of there. Jesus would say it in terms you can't miss. If your eye offends you, pluck it out. If your hand offends you, chop it off. Because the idea there is get away from whatever it is, run away from whatever it is you want that's out of place. Go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and notice verse 7 when it talks about the Jews and we think about them on that Exodus, how the Jews committed idolatry. And we look at that, and that is one that I hear a lot of people talk about, that golden calf situation. When you look at verse 7, it says, don't be idolaters, as were some of them. You know, the Bible is not saying here that it is necessarily worried about you and me getting an Aaron to make us a golden calf to bow down to. No, the word is similar here. Like, you know, as they did. So what's the idea? Well, they were not pleased with God. Their service to God wasn't giving them what they wanted. They weren't believing in God, counting on God. They didn't see the Lord as the rock that follows them. And once they lost that, and once they began to desire and look at the things that the world around in their worship and so forth, notice, don't be idolaters, and then it quotes, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. How many trade their religion, their service to Jesus Christ, for something that's more fun? I mean, let's just be honest about it. It wasn't about necessarily having a golden cow or calf to bow down to as much as it was all the things that went with that. They were fun. The partying that went on with that religion was fun. And they wanted that. And that's the same kind of thing that happens to us. You'll notice in this same passage, note down in verse 14. When he says, my dearly beloved, flee from idolatry. Run away from it. When you find yourself being attracted to giving yourself in service and pursuit and living for, and that's the idea, living for something that you consider to be far more fun than Jesus. When you find yourself moving in that direction, what God's solution for that is, turn around and run. If that means removing yourself from people, places, things, circumstances, situation, if that means filling your mind up, your heart with other things, then whatever it takes, run from it. This isn't something where I need to sit down
and ponder the two and think about it. And boy, this really is fun over here, and this really is not. And all I ever get out of that, because that's when Satan is going to work in your mind. And when you compare the two, fun is always going to win when you think like that. God says, run from it. Notice again here in verse 8, when he says to the Corinthians, and because it was a great threat in their day, and it is in ours. We're at the same place where the Corinthians were. So a great threat to them is neither let us, Paul says, commit fornication. And Paul puts himself in that group. Remember, this is a guy that's not married. This is a guy that probably, when he writes this book, is about my age. So when we talk about, you know, being still and so inclined and all of that kind of thing, that would have been Paul. And Paul said, let's not commit fornication, basically like everybody around us is doing. And the Corinthian society did that. You know, it is said, as you read, you know, from that time, one of the slang terms, and we have vulgar terms for sexual activity and so forth. We have them. They had them too. And in their day, to Corinthian was to commit fornication. They were so known for it. So Paul said, let's not commit fornication. As some of them, those Jews, we may not often think of one of the things that caused God to be so displeased with the Jews on the Exodus was fornication, but it was. So let's not commit fornication like they committed. And in one day, 23,000 fell. They died. And you know what the Bible's solution for fornication is? Turn back to chapter 6. And Paul had already said it here. Look back at 1 Corinthians chapter 6. And go down to verse 13. And as he said to these people, you know, here the common saying for the day is meats for the belly and the belly for meats. But God will destroy both it and them. Now the body is not for fornication, but it is for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. Look down at verse 18. Solution, flee fornication. Same word, run from it. So here we have three things that God has told them. Lust, the idolatry, the fornication, and he's telling us in the New Testament in several passages, run from it. Don't just deal with it. Don't just consider it and make a choice. Run from it. Literally. Notice the next thing that he says, if you look down in verse 9, and I'm going to consider verses 9 and 10 together because I think they go together. The last example that he pointed out to the Corinthians was neither murmur ye, we would say complain today, neither complain as some of them also complained and were destroyed of the destroyer. And as he goes on, I read too quickly, verse 9, neither let us tempt Christ, as some of them tempted and were destroyed of the serpents, and neither complain as they complained. You know, when you begin to look at this and you understand, you go back and you read through these passages, the most common complaint, now I really want you to listen to this, the most common complaint you hear out of those Israelites is that we don't have either what we want, and oftentimes they just said it like, we don't have what we need. And you know, some of their most common complaints, and I'm sure you're aware of this, is we're thirsty and we don't have water. Why did you bring us, they would say to Moses, why did you bring us out into this wilderness to die? We don't have water, we need water. Okay, God gives them water. Next time they get thirsty, we don't have water and we need water. We don't have food and we need food. Okay, God gives them food. The next time they get hungry, we don't have food. Why'd you bring us out here to die? We were better off back in Egypt. We were better off as slaves, and I don't know what they were thinking. Because when you start looking at their picture of crying out to God and being oppressed as slaves, of doing without and suffering and all that they were doing, and yet in their minds, we were better off back there as slaves when we had so much food and to spare. But you know what? That's the way people still think. How many Christians, how many members of the church have I heard talk about the things they need, the basic necessities of life? It doesn't matter to me if you're talking about food and water, or if you're talking about a job, or you're talking about a husband or wife. whatever you're talking about, how many times do Christians get caught up in the same thing, the same kind of complaining? Where is God when I need Him? Why is God not helping me? Why hasn't Jesus done this for me or that for me? I need it. I need it. I need it. And rather than, I know the Lord's with me. I know Jesus is my rock and He's following me. I know that He knows my situation. He's like that parent that loves me, that's following close behind me, and He's going to make sure I get to where I need to be. Instead of thinking like that, we just think about the food we don't have, the water we don't have, the job we don't have, the husband or wife we don't have, or whatever it might be. And we get caught up in the same kind of thinking as these Jews, and it becomes, as it says here, a trial to God. It's trying God. And God says that literally. We see it quoted in Hebrews 3. They tried me. They kept on with their complaining. They tested me. They pushed me. That's the way we would say it today. And they saw my work. When He has enough, when all we're going to do, regardless of what God does for us in our life, is complain. I don't have, I don't have, I need, you're not there for me, you don't love me, etc., etc. When God sees that that's all we're going to do, then God says, fine, that's it. And that's what He did with these Jews. And Paul is saying, don't do that. No, in fact, I want you to turn with me to one more passage. Look at 1 Timothy chapter 6. Isn't it interesting that in this passage in 1 Timothy 6, same kind of thing is said? And I want you to start reading with me, if you will, down in verse 6. Godliness with contentment is great gain. Now that was true of the Jews, it's true of me. Be what you're supposed to be and be content. And it's great gain. But notice this. For we brought nothing into this world, probably thinking about Job here, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. And having food and raiment. You know what I think Paul is saying? What God is saying is, Michael, when you get to thinking like this, you need to stop and think about what you do have. And you need to be content and rely on me. I know what you need. I'm right behind you. I'm following you through life. I know what you need, and more importantly, Michael, I know when you need it. And I'll give it to you when you need it, if you need it. Paul said, having food and raiment, let us be there with content. Now notice verse 9. But they that will be, or are minded to be, or willed to be rich. I don't think the idea here is that being rich is wrong as much as the idea of God can't take care of my needs, but if I were rich, I could have everything I want. And people get to thinking like that. You know, I could have anybody I wanted. I could marry anybody I wanted if I had enough money. I look around me, I don't see too many happy, very rich people that are married. Do you? But that's the way people think. Money, God can't take care of my problems, but money would. That's the individual that is willed to be, minded to be rich, because that's become his God. Notice, they that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare, into many foolish and hurtful lusts that drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is the root of all evil, which while some have coveted after, they've erred or fallen away from the faith and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. Now look at verse 11. What's God's solution? Flee from these things. Isn't it interesting that all of the things that God chose as an example for what the Israelites did, every single one of them in the New Testament has a corresponding verse that says, run from this. Because these are destructive things. These are the things that will bring you down. These are the things that will overthrow you in the wilderness. These are things that will cause you to lose the promised land. Just like them. Finally,
close with me quickly. Go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. One of the greatest threats to the Jew throughout their history, not just on the Exodus, but throughout their history, was their self-confidence, their arrogance, who they were. I am so-and-so, so such-and-such can never happen to me. I'm afraid to boast. I want you to hear this. I am afraid to boast of being a Christian. And I mean that literally. It scares me to make statements like, I'm a Christian, I'm a child of God, nothing can hurt me. Because I know that's the way the Jew thought. And he was constantly in trouble. And I believe that's why Paul says to these Corinthians, if you look down in verse 12, wherefore they lusted, they committed fornication, they were idolaters, they tempted God. Wherefore, that is why, let no man think that he stands. Let him take heed, lest he fall. It's a warning. And something else that he goes on to say in verse 13, as he concludes that thought, there has no temptation taken you. The word taken there is the idea of seasonness. It means we're going through something. That's the way we say it. I'm going through something right now. You're going through something. And now as you're going through it, notice the way you are supposed to think as opposed to the way a lot of us think sometimes. There's no trial, temptation, ordeal that has seized you except four things are true. Notice what he says. First of all, it is common. I'm the only one that ever went through anything like this. No, you ain't. You just are not. It's common. It's similar in similar things, it similarly happens to other people. Second thing, there is nothing that's ever taken you, nothing that sees you, nothing you've gone through, that number two, God was not faithful. What is that idea? The rock follows you. You're that little kid that's running down the road trying to get to wherever you're trying to get to, a little scared maybe inside and all of that. The Lord knows that. Somewhere back there, He's watching you. God is faithful. Number three, there's never been anything I've gone through, nothing that has seized me that I've gone through, that God was not, during the whole thing, providing me with a way of escape. It was there. It was going to appear at some point. I was going to know the way of escape. I was going to be able to understand it, find it, etc. But God was always providing. It was always in place. And number four, nothing has ever seized me that was beyond my ability to bear. When I find myself saying, and so many people do, I can't take this anymore. Yes, you can. Because you would not be going through it if the Lord didn't know you could be. You and I need to remember our rock that follows us and build our hope on Him. We're going to stand and sing a song if you're not a Christian. If tonight you would confess your faith in the Lord, be willing to change your life, be baptized for forgiveness of all of your sins, Jesus will be the rock that's always there with you. We're going to also give you an opportunity, if you're here tonight and you've done that, but you know that you've wandered away, you've not had the faith you need to have, and you want to ask for us all to pray together. We certainly can do that. We'd love to do that together with you. Please come. Mark any minutes.